Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate
vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate
vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 20, Text Number 4. Pitri Deva Manushyanam Vidas Chakshushta Vishwara Shriyastvano Palabdhirte Sajya Sajjanai Horapi Pitri Deva Manushyanam Vidas Chakshushta Vishwara Shriyastvano Prabhirite Sajya Sajjanai Horapi Pitri Deva Manushyanam Vidas Chakshuta Vishwara Shriyastvano Palabdhirte Sajya Saddhanai Orapi Pitri of the forefathers Deva of the demigods, Manushyanam of the human beings, Vida, the Vedic knowledge, Chakshu is the eye, Tava emanating from you, Ishvara, O Supreme Lord, Seha, superior to indeed. Anupalabdhe, in that which cannot be directly perceived. Arthe, in the goals of human life, such as sense gratification, liberation, and attainment of heaven. Sadhya sadhanayo, both in the means and the end. Api, indeed. Translation, my dear Lord, in order to understand those things beyond direct experience, such as spiritual liberation or attainment of heaven and other material enjoyments beyond our present capacity, and in general to understand the means and end of all things, the forefathers, demigods and human beings must consult the Vedic literatures, which are your own laws, for these constitute the highest evidence and revelation. Purport. One might argue that while human beings are certainly prone to ignorance, the elevated forefathers and demigods are considered to be all-knowing within universal affairs. If such superior beings would communicate with the earth, then everyone could bypass Vedic knowledge in achieving his personal desire. This concept is denied here by the words Vedas Chakshu. Even the demigods and forefathers have at best an ambiguous conception of supreme liberation, and even in material affairs they are subject to personal frustration. Although the demigods are all-powerful in awarding material benedictions to inferior species such as human beings, they are sometimes thwarted in their personal programs of sense gratification. A rich businessman, for example, may have no difficulty paying the insignificant salary of one of his innumerable workers, but the same wealthy man may be completely frustrated in his dealings with his own family and friends, and may also be defeated in his attempts to expand his fortune by further investments. Although a rich man appears to be all-powerful to his subordinate workers, he must personally struggle to fulfill his personal desires. Similarly, the demigods and forefathers encounter many difficulties in maintaining and expanding their celestial standard of living. They must therefore constantly take shelter of superior Vedic knowledge. Even in the administration of cosmic affairs, they strictly follow the guidelines of the Vedas, which are the laws of God. If such fabulous entities as demigods must take shelter of the Vedas, we can just imagine the position of human beings, who are frustrated at virtually every step of their lives. Every human being should accept Vedic knowledge as the highest evidence in material and spiritual affairs. Uddhava points out to the Lord that if one accepts the authority of Vedic knowledge, it is seemingly impossible to reject the concept of material piety and sin. Thus, Uddhava persists in examining the Lord's controversial statement at the end of the last chapter. Reading the verse again. Pichi diva manushanam vides chakshus tavishvaraha shriyas tanu halabdherite sajya sadanayor api. My dear Lord, in order to understand those things beyond direct experience, such as spiritual liberation or attainment of heaven and other material enjoyments, beyond our present capacity, and in general to understand the means and end of all things, the forefathers, demigods and human beings must consult the Vedic literatures, which are your own laws, for these constitute the highest evidence and revelation. So, in the previous chapter, Krishna summarized the conversation that he has been having with Uddhava, saying that Uddhava should not be immersed in the good and bad, or the concepts of piety and sin within this world, but should think of in transcendental terms beyond these subject matters. Uddhava is questioning, of course, that that would mean, therefore, that one would have to somehow or another reject the concepts which are actually offered in the Vedas. And by rejecting the concepts offered in the Vedas, in essence, Uddhava is questioning, are we rejecting the Vedas, Vedic authority? And if we reject the Vedic authority, are we not rejecting the authority of the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself? So therefore, he is offering these challenges not so much as in the mood of someone who knows more than Krishna, but in the mood of knowing that the Lord may be able to easily remove any doubts or inconsistent understandings that may be there, not only within Uddhava but within others who follow over the course of time. So in this chapter, of course, the chapter is entitled Pure Devotional Service. So in this chapter, Krishna is presenting that one should take up pure devotional service as a transcendental activity. One should serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead in pure devotional service. And that this is what one should be concentrating on as one goes through one's study of the Vedas, and as one tries to follow the injunctions of the Vedas. One should be trying to follow the injunctions of the Vedas with the aim to come into the platform of engaging in pure devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And if one is not having that aim, then one's activities in following the Vedas are in effect useless. So so Krishna is not actually saying to Uddhava to reject the Vedas, but he's saying to reject following the Vedas without understanding their purpose. And if we're simply absorbed in the concepts of good and bad, sin and piety, and we have no concept of devotional service to the Supreme Lord, then we're wasting our time in following the Vedas. But if we follow those same Vedic knowledge, and we have the clear aim of coming to the platform of pure devotional service to the Supreme Lord, then our following of those same Vedic injunctions are fruitful. Therefore we see in the Srimad Bhagavatam, actually these things are all described right from the very beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and here Krishna is giving further elaboration on topics which were presented in a seed form by Sudha Goswami. So we see that in the second chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Sudha Goswami says, Sarvaipum sham paro dharmo yato bhakir adhokshaje ahaitakiya pratihata yayatna suprasidati. The supreme occupation, dharma, for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving devotional service unto the transcendent Lord. Such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. So actually the same thing is being stated there, that you know, one should understand that the occupation that all human beings should be engaged in is that occupation which leads one to develop their love for God. Otherwise, therefore, Srila Prabhupada stating these things in very simple terms, he says that religiosity, which, you know, means dharma, artha, karma and moksha, or, you know, religiosity, economic development, sense gratification and liberation, all of these things are actually the preparation ground for coming to the spiritual platform. So if we follow the Vedas in that light, that all of the concepts of good and bad, piety and sin, we're following these not because they're the all in all, but because they're a preparation ground for coming to the spiritual platform. Then there's value. But if we take those injunctions dealing with piety and sin as all in all, not understanding that eventually we have to develop our love for God, there's no value. In the same way, you know, you take that example that if you take a field and you cultivate that field, so you're preparing the ground, and you know, you turn it over and you may lay some, you know, fertilizer, and you may remove all the weeds. But if you don't plant the seed, then what is the value? You have a beautifully prepared ground and you don't plant the crop. See, so that is like following the Vedas without understanding that, you know, after the preparation is done, we're going to plant the seed of love of God within the heart. And, you know, all the preparation is to make the heart a fertile place, you know, free from weeds, you know, and receptive. So, therefore, we see in the Srimad Bhagavatam that, again, going back to the second chapter, that Sudha Goswami describes that in the eighth verse, Dharma Sanustita Pumsham Vishvakshina katushuyaha not pariyad yati yadi ritim shama eva hi kevalam. The occupational activities a man performs according to his own position are only so much useless labour if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the Personality of Godhead. So, if a person is following the Vedas and they're not becoming attracted to the Supreme Lord, again, it is a useless waste of time. Their study and practice of the Vedas. We see that many people have an official understanding of God at best. There are many, of course, who follow religious principles with no understanding of God. Some may even do it by social custom and don't even believe that God exists. Some may believe that God exists, but they have an official understanding. Yes, God is there, but my real attraction is to my enjoying the material world. That's where the attraction is. And they're not developing their attraction to the Supreme Lord himself and their eternal relationship. If they remain fully attracted to the material enjoyment rather than attracted to the spiritual platform, they cannot make any progress in their Vedic pursuits or religious pursuits. And therefore, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur gives the example of the wedding party, the groom's party. We have a big wedding on Saturday. So we hope everyone arrives. But in this story, the groom's party, they were going to the place of the bride, as is traditional, and they were taking the high road, which in those days meant the river. And so they all boarded the boat and asked the boatman to row them across the river. So, and they were very merry on their way, and they rowed throughout the night. And in the morning, they looked and they saw that actually we haven't gone anywhere. And so they asked the boatman, what is the meaning of this? And the boatman said, no, I was rowing all night. And then someone looked and saw, oh, the anchor is still there. So, if the anchor is there, you can actually row around in circles, thinking you're going somewhere, because you're actually attached to the bottom. You can row, you can be moving, and it can seem like you're actually going somewhere, but you're not going anywhere. That anchor is there. So, maintaining a strong attraction to the material world and to enjoying the material world, even though performing religious activities, religiosity, is keeping that anchor, one cannot actually make progress. One actually has to remove that anchor transfer one's attraction from material things to the spiritual platform. So, if, of course, people have a material conception, they have an official understanding of God, and they're approaching God for materialistic reasons, they can never rise above a material conception of God. And generally such persons who have a material conception of God may see him as impersonal, and therefore may see that he manifests his forms in variety within the material world, but on the spiritual platform he's actually impersonal. That's the material conception of God, and therefore they see God within many different demigods. So you'll see that in India, and of course we have here also, when they established a Hindu temple, it is like a god shop. Yeah, as Srila Prabhupada says, it's like a, you know, you go shopping for your sense gratification, and you know, on this shelf we have, you know, this goddess is offering this particular sense gratification, and you offer some, you know, worship, and this god is offering this particular type of benediction. You know, so it's like you're shopping for your material sense gratification, and according to the, you know, what you require, there are so many different gods, and you can, you know, go around like that. There's not much difference. Actually, the mentality is not much difference than, you know, going shopping in the supermarket. It is so far removed from actually a spiritual understanding of the Supreme Lord and approaching Him in a mood of pure devotional service. So, I want to speak of the fact that, as Srila Sudha Goswami describes here also in the second chapter, that, you know, we actually have to approach Vishnu Tattva, not Jiva Tattva. The demigods are in fact jivas, or, you know, tiny little spirit souls in a powerful material body. They, as described in this verse, even the demigods and forefathers and human beings, they don't understand how to achieve liberation. They're not liberated themselves. They don't even understand it clearly, let alone to give it to others. If you want liberation, you actually have to approach, you know, Vishnu Tattva, who, and approaching Vishnu Tattva is approached through a proper understanding of the Vedic knowledge gained through a guru who is coming in the line of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we see this actually, this topic is taken up further in the fifth chapter of the first canto, where Srila Vyasadeva, having compiled all the Vedic knowledge and written it, is then feeling dissatisfied, and he's asking Narada Muni, and Narada Muni is explaining to him. We see here in the verse 12 of the fifth chapter, it says, Naiskamyam afichutta bhava dvadvitam na sabate jnanam malam niranjanam gudaha punaha sasvat dvadram misvare nacharapitam karma yadapyakaranam. Knowledge of self-realization, even though free of all material affinity, does not look well if devoid of a conception of the infallible God. So the same point. What then is the use of fruitive activities which are naturally painful from the very beginning and transient by nature, if they are not utilized for the devotional service of the Lord? They're saying the same thing. So, and then we see in verse 15, it is describing, Narada is saying that, you know, you have to clearly give this transcendental conception, this transcendental goal of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and devotional service to Him. Otherwise, people are already naturally attracted to sense gratification. And if you describe religious processes which encourage them, they're simply going to continue engaging in sense gratification in the name of religion, and even though there are prohibitions there, they're not going to be very interested in those prohibitions. They're just going to be interested in all the, you know, the allowances for sense gratification within the religious scriptures. So therefore, he says, Jugupsitam dharmakitte nu sasataha subhava raktasya mahan pitikramaha yad vyakyato dharma iti taraha sito na manyate tasa nivaranam jinaha. The people in general are naturally inclined to enjoy, and you have encouraged them in that way in the name of religion. This is verily condemned and is quite unreasonable. Because they are guided under your instructions, they will accept such activities in the name of religion and will hardly care for prohibitions. So especially because it's coming in the name of Srila Vyasadeva, anything that promotes sense gratification, they'll say, oh, it's here in the Vedas. We can eat meat. And you see that with, you know, different religions around the world. Right? If you ask them why they're eating meat, and they will find, oh, it says here. You know, there's a whole other, you know, huge volumes of instructions asking them to be non-violent and not controlled by the senses and what have you. They're not very important instructions. That instruction, that vague, you know, word that we've somehow twisted around in a slightly different meaning, condones our eating of meat, and therefore it's meat for dinner every night according to religious principles. Straight from the slaughterhouse. Now, I'd like to see them find that in the scriptures, you know. Yeah. You know, even the scriptures that allow some concession. You know, you don't see, yeah, open up the slaughterhouse and just, you know, slaughter them wholesale and then just put it onto the dinner table. You know. So, if there's the slightest little foothold, you know, into the door for sense gratification, they'll take that. And all the prohibitions, they'll neglect, but those, anything that allows them to have sense gratification, they say, it's there in the scripture. Vyasadeva said it. That is why Lord Buddha had to appear to actually take the Vedas, just take the whole Vedas off the whole culture as such abuse. So, therefore, you know, Narada Muni in the next verse, he's saying to Vyasadeva, you must set the proper goal for people to follow. The Supreme Lord is unlimited. Only a very expert personality, retired from the activities of material happiness, deserves to understand this knowledge of spiritual values. Therefore, those who are not so well situated due to material attachment should be shown the ways of transcendental realization by your goodness through descriptions of the transcendental activities of the Supreme Lord. And therefore, Srila Vyasadeva, from the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, of the Srimad Bhagavatam, after receiving this instruction, straight away, yes, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Brahma also. Ishvaraha Parama Krishna. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God. Very direct, straight from the beginning. Very boldly, so that it is immediately understood. Here is the God, Krishna, who is known as Vasudev. He is the son of Vasudev and Devaki. Vasudev. So, this is also stated by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 15th chapter, text 15, that Krishna is the goal of all Vedic knowledge, and that he is the compiler of the Vedas. Srila Vyasadeva is understood to be an incarnation of the Lord, Shaktivesavata, empowered incarnation of the Lord, and therefore he is Krishna, compiling the Vedas. So he knows the purpose of the Vedas, and he has stated, so the compiler of all Vedic knowledge, Srila Vyasadeva, although he compiled the Vedanta Sutra, he knew that rascal commentators would come later and give misinterpretations, because the Vedanta Sutra, which is the conclusion of all Vedic knowledge, is only understood by those who are very, very intelligent. Big, big brain, as Prabhupada would say. And, you know, great scholars in Sanskrit and all the Vedas. You know, they can understand Vedanta Sutra because Vedanta Sutra means it is the conclusion of all the Vedas, but it is written in codes. So therefore the beginning, Atato Brahma Jigyasya, now in this human form of life, is time to inquire into the Absolute. You know, in four words, it actually sums up the whole purpose of the human form of life. And then the next aphorism, Tanmad Yasya Yataha, again in four words describes that one should, what is that that we're inquiring? One should search for the ultimate cause of the material creation, and the cause of maintenance of creation, and the cause of destruction of creation. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Vyasadeva points out, Tanmad Yasya Yataha, that that ultimate cause is Krishna, the son of Vasudeva Devaki. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But, although he points it out in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it is not as easily understood in the Vedanta Sutra because one has to be very, very intelligent to understand those concise codes. You know, within four words, they sum up the whole purpose of human life. And in four words, they sum up, you know, how to inquire into transcendence by seeking out the cause of material. So very, very, very concise. It's very easy to be misunderstood by those who are not intelligent and not expert in Sanskrit. It's also very easy to be misinterpreted by those who actually want to propose some nonsense diversion of what Srila Vyasadeva said. Therefore, although there are many commentators on the Vedanta Sutra, if we actually want to know, you know, who is the cause of all causes, we should approach the author, Srila Vyasadeva. Why approach someone else who commentates on the Vedanta Sutra? Why not approach the author? If anyone would know, Srila Vyasadeva would know. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam is so important because it is his commentary. Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Vyasadeva is saying, this is the purpose of why, you know, of what I meant in the Vedanta Sutra, which is the conclusion of all Vedic knowledge. So Srila Prabhupada tells a story that there was in India there was this person, I think he was an office worker, but he was also, he wrote books on drama, and he wrote one book called Shah Jahan. And now, after writing this book, one of his friends came to him and said, you've given this title of the book Shah Jahan, which is, you know, this person, but actually it seems that the real hero of the book is Aurangzeb. And you know, so you've given it the wrong title, and so the because, you know, he's saying that, you know, so much of the story is about his son Aurangzeb rather than Shah Jahan, the father. He said, no, the hero of the story is Shah Jahan. And then he explained why, that Shah Jahan, he had his wife, Mumtaz. She died. What's that?
Mumtaz.
That's
Mumtaz.
It. That's it. Say that again.
Mumtaz.
That's it. Yeah. She died very early, and he was, you know, brokenhearted by the loss of his wife. So he actually spent all his wealth building the Taj Mahal. as a memorial to his wife. And in this way, he had, I think, four or five sons. And they became a bit neglected because he was just always thinking of his wife and building the Taj Mahal, I think. So one of them, Aurangzeb, is that?
Yeah.
That's him. Yeah. He became crooked because of his poor upbringing. And therefore, in order to usurp his father's kingdom, he killed his elder brother and others, I think other siblings, and put his father in jail. Shah Jahan. So Shah Jahan was in jail and he was lamenting, you know, the reactions to his activities and thinking how he had lost his wife and how his, you know, family had turned crooked and some had died and like this. So the story is about him and his lamentation and his plight. Okay. But so therefore, if you want to know, you ask the author. Yes, here is the hero. He is the, you know, the goal. He is the main focus of this book, not Aurangzeb. Like this. So in the same way, you know, if you want to know, so what is the goal of all the Vedas and what is the conclusion of the Vedanta Sutra? Ask the author. Śrīla Vyāsadeva. And Śrīla Vyāsadeva states that in Śrīmad Bhāgavatam. From the very beginning, from the very first verse, makes it very clear. So, therefore, you know, and he does this because Narada Muni, his spiritual master, instructed him that you must do this because people are already naturally inclined towards sense gratification. And if you, you know, the author of the Vedas, encourage them through religious activities, they'll not care for the prohibitions and they'll just engage in sense gratification, birth after birth, in the name of religiosity. So you must give the very clear goal so that they can pull out that anchor and actually get some benefit from Vedic knowledge. Instead of always meditating on piety and sin and the duality, good and bad, they should just be meditating on the real goal, and that is coming to the transcendental platform beyond the material conception of piety and sin and what have you. So, therefore, we see verse number 17 of the fifth chapter. Very interesting point here that Narada Muni is saying to Śrīla Vyāsadeva, therefore, you know, you preach Krishna consciousness, preach Srimad Bhagavatam, preach devotional service. And he says, I'll read it to you, Chakvāsvādramam chanam bojham hare hajan abhak vo ta patet tato idi ichakva babadram abut amushakim kovata apto bhajitam svadhanam mataha. One who has forsaken his material occupations to engage in the devotional service of the Lord may sometimes fall down while in an immature stage. Yet there is no danger of his being unsuccessful. On the other hand, a non-devotee, though fully engaged in occupational duty, does not gain anything. So he's saying, you know, under all circumstances, you present the goal of trying to attain the transcendental platform of engaging in devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And if someone somehow deviates from their occupational duty according to other religious principles and they take to this devotional service and they fall down, that person can only be considered to have gained. There's no loss. But that person who executes their religious activities wonderfully with this official understanding of God but no attraction to devotional service to the Supreme Lord, never taking up that path at all, for them there is no gain whatsoever. So we see in the Bhagavad Gita that Krishna explains that if someone takes to the path of yoga and devotional service and they fall down due to immaturity, or you know, they may be executing nicely devotional service and their life may come to an end untimely, there's no loss, because they will given an opportunity to take birth again in a family where they can continue that transcendental activity. So there's no loss. Whereas, you know, those who do not engage in devotional service, they're not given that, you know, facility. And they can take birth in all sorts of different, you know, species of life or human beings, but they have to begin again from the very beginning of their material activities. So an interesting thing here, actually, in one of the lectures, sometimes we may see that someone who's actually engaged in devotional service gives up devotional service and becomes very, very degraded. So, in that case, just like Srila Prabhupada discussing, that sometimes people commit grievous offences in the holy dharma, you know, the land where Krishna was born, or that, and they can actually take birth as animals in that dharma. And although generally one who takes devotional service takes a human form of life, it's not absolutely guaranteed. You know, if someone is really becomes really, really degraded in their consciousness and activities, even after executing some little bit of devotional service, they can take birth as an animal. But Srila Prabhupada says, you know, but still, for that person there's no loss. And actually he was giving this lecture on New Vrindavan, and he was saying, just see, you know, the dogs here on this farm. They're different to all other dogs, because they've been given facility from some previous birth. There is some, you know, whatever contact may have been there, whatever, they've been given some special privilege that their dogs, somehow they've taken a degraded birth due to degraded activities, but somehow or another, due to, you know, some contact with Krishna consciousness, what are they doing as dogs? They're constantly hearing the chanting, Hare Krishna, all day, all night. They're associating with devotees. They're eating Krishna prasad, they're going to the temple, they're rendering service to the devotees. So even, you know, even showing that even if one becomes really degraded, if there's some slight trace of devotional service somewhere in someone's past history, there's no loss, because Krishna will give that person somehow or another the chance to actually advance in Krishna consciousness despite their degraded condition. I know the dog I had on the farm, Haridas. You know why I called him Haridas? I called him Haridas because if he didn't do what he was told, I was going to beat him in 22 marketplaces. So, but he was actually very he knew that. He knew that, so he was actually a very good dog. But as a pup, I had to be very strict with him, and after that, he was just a real pleasure to be around devotees. Except he would take their shoes, but I think he wanted the dust from their feet. But apart from that, he would never pass through within sight of any devotee. In fact, you could search the farm and you would never find his stool. He was just so considerate. That's unheard of in a dog, but you could search, but you will never find. And I never ever saw him except when he was a pup, past stool or urine, ever. Right, you know. So there's some. He used to come to Mangalati every morning. Every morning he'd come, and you know, he'd sit outside, of course. He'd hear the chanting, all the prayers. He'd hear me chanting my 16 rounds, and then he'd have some bhisharam and we'd go home like that. And on the way up, he did a service that, you know, because I used to walk from the house to the farm, and there's no lights, it's just pitch black. Some nights you couldn't see your hand, you just held up in front of your face. And there were huge kangaroos, you know, they'd all come out at night and they'd be all on the path. And he would run in front of me and chase the kangaroos off the path, you know. Because if you walk into one of those, they can kill you, you know, just boom, like that. And he actually saved my life. One time, I was the only one on the farm, which wasn't unusual. And I was walking from the temple down to one of the ashrams. And Hari Das was just a little bit in front of me. And I was sort of chanting him around, just looking at straight ahead of the ashram. And then he started sniffing the ground just where I was walking. And I thought, what is that? You know, there may be some snake or something. So I looked down, and right next to my foot, there was this tiger snake who had arched up like this, and who was right next to my leg and about to strike. So I was going to almost stand on his head. So as soon as I go to put my foot down, he would just strike. He was arched like that. Seeing him like that, I actually sort of pirouetted up. You know, so it was like probably all the dancing, you know, this has come in handy. So I did. I sort of pirouetted up so that I didn't put my foot down and sort of landed across there. But had I, you know, he was sort of sniffing, you know, don't step there, Gunga, you know. Like this, he could tell there was a snake, and when I saw him doing that, I thought maybe there's a snake, and I looked down, and it saved my life because I was the only one on the farm. By the time I would have walked back to the house, and even called the ambulance, by the time they got there, I would have been dead. Yeah.
Too late.
It would have been too late. I would have been dead. So yeah, he actually saved my life. So in this way, but the point is, of course, that Srila Prabhupada explains that if you take the devotional service, under no circumstances is there any loss, because Krishna will, you know, give you gain in unlimited way, even if you fall from the path. But if you don't take the devotional service, even you're following religious principles very, very strictly according to the Vedas, no attraction to the Supreme Lord or his devotional service, there's actually no gain at all. So therefore, take up devotional service and preach Krishna consciousness through the Srimad Bhagavatam to everyone you meet. Hare Krishna. Any comments or questions? Yeah. Devotional food? I used to feed him prasadam. He never had meat. He used to get his own meat. You know, the odd lizard here. You know, if he wanted a little bit of meat, he'd just go and get it in the forest. But he loved prasadam. It was his favourite. And just on that, one may think that somehow because he didn't have meat, that somehow he was lacking. But I was describing the other week, he was so fit. You know, he used to just run, and I mean up big hills from morning to night, and he used to chase the cars in front of the cars. And no matter how fast you go, he would beat you. He was fit as anything, and there was no meat. We have to be able to show why, you know, the Vishnu Tattva is superior to the Jiva Tattva of the demigods, and explain that concept to them. So. Well, just because Lord Shiva may sometimes display more power than Krishna, sometimes various demigods display more power than Krishna. That doesn't mean that they're ultimately superior. So, for instance, you know, there are many examples where a superior person allows an inferior person to display some prowess to encourage them or to give them an opportunity to show their glories at that. So, for instance, one may be with one's son or daughter, and it may be their birthday or something, some special day. They're with all their friends, and they're describing some knowledge. Now, as a parent, we may know better and more than what they've just said, but we just leave it so that they've attained some glory and some credit for what they know. Not that we want to show them up, and you know, we want to just display, allow them to show their prowess. So, and the silence of the parent appears that they're in a subordinate position, listening, hearing, taking instruction. So just because a person sometimes shows superiority doesn't necessarily mean that that is their ultimate position. And then, of course, you know, if we can show why someone is ultimately, you know, superior, then that is good. Srila Vyasadeva in the Srimad Bhagavatam at the beginning, he describes that actually only Krishna is a Vigyasvara, fully independent and fully conscious, whereas Lord Shiva actually meditates upon whom? For his power? Who does Lord Shiva, he meditates upon, is it Mahasankirtan? For his power. Krishna doesn't meditate on anyone for his power. So that shows that Lord Shiva is dependent and Krishna is not. So those, if you can, especially those, you know, if you can show how Krishna is the only independent person, whereas all others, including Shiva, are dependent, then you can show the ultimate superiority. Yeah. But if you get caught up in, you know, one displayed this power and he, you know, it's difficult.
I tend to not argue about
yeah.
She worships the Krishna, he's also on her altar.
Yes.
So, but I mean, I'm just like, how can I attract you towards devotional service? She does do devotional service, but it's up to her Shiva.
Yeah.
So, but then she makes Shiva come down with her, you know, and say that he's praying. So, it's like, yeah. I'm not very philosophical. I mean, how can I try to show by example, you know, just by being happy and
yeah.
jolly.
The more she hears, you know, if there are different, you know, if she likes certain stories or pastimes and you can sometimes just describe, the more she hears about Krishna, even, it doesn't matter whether when you're describing about Krishna's pastimes that she actually feels that you're winning the argument or she's winning the argument. If you leave that whole concept out, if she actually goes on hearing, the purification will kick in. Yeah. So just give her the opportunity to hear and just leave the question of who's better and not. Yeah. Automatically with purification she will see. And prasadam, chanting like that. Yeah.
You can partly answer the question by putting what is your root? Everybody gets.
Yeah, that's a fact. She probably thinks Lord Shiva is the root, though.
Exactly. I've heard one comment.
Just before we do that, Rasa, was your comment on that same subject?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah, you know, one of the biggest things is by association, because Sudha Goswami, you know, we were quoting the second chapter, and the next couple of verses he describes that if you associate with devotees, and Narada Muni then goes on to describe the same thing, his personal experience, that if you associate with devotees, you'll naturally develop the inclination to hear about Krishna. Because if you associate with Shivites, you'll see, okay, this is what they're into. And then you associate with devotees and you think, I want to know what they're into, because their lifestyle, their peacefulness, their happiness, their ecstasy is attracting me. That, you know, the yogis and the Shivites and their impersonalism and this, that and the other, and their, you know, lack, and their, you know, ganja and this, that and the other, and lack of whatever, is not going to attract it. So if she associates with devotees, she's going to say, even though, you know, I feel that Shiva is the supreme, I really want to see what makes these devotees so happy and ecstatic and transcendental. Like that. So association with devotees, and then hearing and taking the shadam and their association, she'll naturally be inclined to hear from them. Yeah. She won't get that from Shivites. Even associating with Shivites, she actually won't be so much attracted to become a Shivite, you know, something. It'll actually turn her away, if anything. Yeah. Srila Prabhupada answers that in the same section, in the purport, that, you know, the devotees, they understand Krishna's real purpose. Here we see, you know, with the whole past of Narada Muni instructing Vyasadeva, that in order for you to be satisfied, in order for anyone to be satisfied through their, you know, Vedic pursuits, they must be heading towards Krishna consciousness. Right? So that must be there, otherwise they're wasting their time. So that is the goal of all Vaishnavas. It's coming from the top, from Narada Muni, Srila Vyasadeva, because Narada Muni is getting it from Narayana Rishi, who's an expansion of Krishna. So everyone understands, you know, the Supreme Lord wants us to preach from our Bhagavatam. And then you have people who are become disturbed if we try and do that. The goal is not to disturb them. The goal is to attract them. If we're just going to disturb them and they don't become attracted, better leave things as they are. They may be making some progress.
What happens to someone that rebels to your government
mentally ill and then practices similar practices yourself? Such as
travel, using
the third eye, all those. Oh, we let the government deal with that. No, I'm serious as well. If someone gets reported to the government, we just let the government deal with it. Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
So it's like an organisation
that
attacks
other
beliefs using the tool of the Australian government's medical system.
Is that related to this verse?
Really,
really. Yeah. I'll just finish with her. Is that alright? Because she was asking me a question. That's good. Thank you. Where were we? Oh, we were discussing how some people become disturbed. Which, as we can see, happens very easily. If people do become disturbed, we should, you know, tread very carefully, of course. There's no benefit, because people can become offensive to the devotees, to the Lord, even in the presence of the Lord. So we have to tread very, very carefully. But if there's the slightest opportunity that there's a little disturbance, but they'll accept that and, you know, elevate themselves to a spiritual platform, then we should take it. Yeah. But certainly, you know, it's actually very risky being a devotee of the Lord, because if you preach Krishna consciousness, you will come across so many opposing people from all walks of life. Srila Prabhupada, again, we were talking about the Taj Mahal before. There's one building in Calcutta which is a monument to Victoria. I think it's Queen Victoria. When they were building that, Srila Prabhupada was a little boy. And as a little boy, I think it was King Edward, the one who abdicated the throne because he married someone. There was some reason. So he came, and Prabhupada was just a few years old, but he remembers, you know, we had a good lunch that day. We had kachuras and this, that and the other in our tiffin. And he saw the king. He came past. And they built this monument for him. Huge. And Prabhupada said that when they almost finished that, he used to go to the top, and he was just a little boy, and he'd walk along the scaffolding. This. And his disciples said to him, you know, when he was telling the story, "Oh, Prabhupada, you were very brave then." And Srila Prabhupada said, "I'm still brave. Because otherwise, how would I come alone and preach Krishna consciousness in the West if I wasn't still brave?" Because there are so many, you know, it is so difficult to give people spiritual consciousness in this very materialistic world. And it's a very dangerous thing. So, you know, we should be careful for our own sake and for the sake of others in disturbing people. But if there's the slightest little opportunity, we should understand that that is the Lord's real business, to help people to understand that they're an eternal spirit soul, and that they have an eternal relationship with the Supreme Lord, and that they should love God. And they can do that whether they're a Christian, a Muslim, you know, or what have you. The same principle, as we described that verse by Sudha Goswami. Srimad Bhagavatam does not say one religion is better than another. It says to love God is a superior activity for everyone. Like that. So I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. And invite everyone, please come and take prasadam upstairs and enjoy the hospitality of the temple. Hare Krishna.